Good morning. You are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. The beginning of our live broadcast day at 11.04 a.m. A little late, but here now, 11.04, for the final day of February 2015. This is the Mideast Migraines Program.
Thank you. Kentabawa itu inti wabata Hetung bosu hasta mihme Inni sayim meni fatran
Good morning again. I'm Ren Tawil, host of the Mideast Migraine Show, the weekend edition here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Streaming live at freakradio.org. That's freakradio.org. If you want to listen online, go to our webpage and click on listen and follow those instructions for tuning in our online feed, or simply click on the red oval atop the pictured radio transmitter. Yes, let's get going with this All Saturday editions of Mideast Migraines are dedicated to the readings of important works, important recent or fairly recent books and things concerning the debacle between Israel and Palestine, or between Israel and other Arabs in the region. Before I begin the actual reading of Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine, I have a very important announcement for something which is taking place this evening. University of California at Santa Cruz graduate in history, Christopher Bolin, B-O-L-L-Y-N, Christopher Bolin, will present his books and a talk, Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. This will take place at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, the old RCNV, this evening, Saturday, February 28, tonight at 7 p.m. The Resource Center is located at 612 Ocean Street. That's 612 Ocean Street in Santa Cruz. Again, at 7 p.m. tonight. Books are available for sale. A donation is requested, $5 to $10, and no one will be turned away for lack of funds. This is, after all, a highly important educational activity sponsored by the Santa Cruz Peace and Freedom Party. Little blurb here. In the name of 9/11, quote, wars have been waged, governments overthrown, and an untold number of lives sacrificed, end quote. Yet 9/11 is an unsolved crime of terrorism and mass murder, with no trial and no serious investigation. This elaborately planned criminal deception was carried out, and again I quote, with the intention that the public would be deceived with a false explanation blaming the atrocity on Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Just rotating a few items here, folks. Christopher Bolin states he has written Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, because he could not remain indifferent and silent. Quote, as the lies about 9/11 were used to wage wars of aggression and transform America into a police state. An investigative journalist from Illinois, Bolin sojourned in Europe and the Middle East before studying languages, history, and journalism at the University of California in Davis and Santa Cruz. His degree in history focused on the Israeli occupation of Palestine. He has written in-depth articles about the Middle East, electronic vote fraud, the dangers of depleted uranium, and the history and geopolitical background of 9/11. In 2007, Bolin and his family moved to Sweden when his research into 9/11 brought about his being attacked by undercover police and then charged with assaulting them. Boleyn being charged with assaulting undercover police. Right. He began writing this book and has been touring in the U.S. with the hope of raising the consciousness of the American public and exposing the true culprits. Readers of this book have said it is, and I quote, the top-notch work of the 9/11 collection and the work of a brave genius, information we can use to reformulate our worldview. Gives me hope that truth and liberty can ultimately prevail. Still believe the official version or think you know who done it? Come find out. It may not be exactly who you think. His books will be available at this talk. More information at www.boleyn.com. And again, Boleyn is spelled B-O-L-L-Y-N. Boleyn.com. There is also an informational email address, mms1942@cruzio.com. Again, mms1942@cruzio.com. Again, the gist of this announcement, and I will make it once more before the end of this program. UCSC graduate in history Christopher Boleyn will present his books this evening at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, 612 Ocean Street, Santa Cruz. This talk is entitled, and I believe this is also the title of his premier work, his premier writing, Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World. Tonight at 7 p.m. RCNV. Books available for sale. Obviously, quite needed to get that out of the way. Now we can turn again to Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine, A Jewish-American Woman in the Occupied Territories. This book is copyrighted 2007, although she begins the book with her writings beginning in 2003. 2007, updated and revised last year. This was actually sent to me by a U.S.-based group, the U.S. the group is entitled The U.S. Campaign to End the Israeli Occupation. I didn't even ask for it. Maybe they just had an S-load of these books that they wanted to get rid of. But I did begin this. The reading officially began it last Saturday, so we're still pretty much into the beginning. And let me just remind people, I will not be taking phone calls until, in about 45 minutes or so. The mid-show break, we go until about 1 o'clock in the afternoon. So I will give the phone numbers out later. Thank you for joining us. Here we go. These are unnumbered chapterettes. We are now, it reads like a journal, a diary. Monday, November 24, 2003. Jenine Camp. Jenine is J-E-N-I-N. Today we went north to visit Jenine City and refugee camp. Jenine City has a different feel from other cities I visited in Palestine. It feels somehow wounded. While the people are not unfriendly, many are suspicious after what they have experienced. We visited the ISM, that's the International Solidarity Movement, apartment in Jenine, to look at pictures for an exhibition they were preparing. The pictures, drawn by 12-year-old Palestinian children, given a free drawing task, were of tanks and soldiers cutting down trees and shooting men, women, and children. No drawing was without violence or bloodshed. One picture showed a group of children with backpacks running from a tank. A child had fallen into a ditch behind the rest and was about to be shot. Another picture, again, these are drawn by approximately 12-year-old Palestinian little Arab children. Another picture showed a pregnant woman kneeling on the floor, crying at the sight of her dead and bloodied son. Behind her, a large hole in the wall revealed the tank that had destroyed the house and killed the young man. If this sounds familiar to any of you, it is because I did begin reading this chapter last week, but since we didn't get too far into it, I am rereading this chapterette from the beginning. Continuing now. Another picture showed two soldiers standing on a tank pointing guns at two children walking to school. A friend translated the Arabic script for me. One soldier was saying, "You may not go to school," to which one of the children was responding, "We won't go home. We will go to school and we will learn and we will stay here to protect our land in Jerusalem, our capital." At the top right of the page was written, "Despite the siege and handcuffs, we will stay here with our children until we achieve our goal of freedom and independence." Jenin has a reputation for fighting back. Locals say that in April of 2002, it took 12,000 Israeli troops 8 days to capture one small section of the city because so many people fought to the death. Many residents have shown that they would rather die than surrender their homes and lives to military control. Nonetheless, Jenin is now effectively imprisoned by the wall, which separates the city from its land and nearby villages. Most of the fertile soil for which Jenin is famous is now inaccessible, most of it. The three Palestinian villages in the Seam on the other side of the wall are under constant pressure from the Israeli government to move. Israel frequently cuts their water and electricity off. 2 weeks ago, Palestinians and international solidarity volunteers succeeded in a direct action of cutting through a fence section of the wall north of Jenin. 2 days later, it was rebuilt even stronger, but protesters went back last Saturday to show that they would not be deterred. The second protest was successful in that it made the front page of the Israeli mainstream newspaper Haaretz, but it was also tragic in that a young boy was shot and killed by the Israeli army in Jenin, during ISM's absence. The boy was 12 years old, a fifth grader named Ibrahim. Violence in Jenin is not uncommon. According to locals, Israeli occupation forces shot 7 young Palestinians in a nearby village earlier this month, 2 of whom died. They were dressed in their best clothes, making their way home for iftar, the ceremonial breaking of the Ramadan fast. Locals also recounted an incident in which 3 teenage boys were taken into the forest and severely beaten. Apparently, one soldier struck a gun in a boy's face and said, "At the count of 3, I will shoot you." But another soldier intervened. The boys returned to their homes with bruises all over their bodies. One boy's eye was nearly poked out. They said the soldiers had made them eat grass like animals. The military has maintained a frequent presence in Jenin since the violent spring of 2002. That March, a deadly Palestinian suicide attack on the eve of Passover in the city of Netanya killed almost 30 Israelis. Allegedly in response to the bombing, but using an offensive plan far in advance, and then in parentheses here, in part by studying German tactics and taking over the Warsaw Ghetto in Poland, according to one Israeli officer, Israeli soldiers driving American-made bulldozers plowed through the center of Jenin refugee camp, home to 13,000 impoverished Palestinians, a handful of whom had been putting up armed resistance to the Israeli military takeover. Soldiers bulldozed homes indiscriminately, without regard to whether any civilians were still inside. According to Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, HRW. Israel then prevented medical and humanitarian relief workers from entering the camp for more than 10 days while victims perished under the rubble. Thousands of survivors were rendered homeless for the second time in recent history, the first time being in 1948 when they became refugees. Amnesty and HRW both found that most of the destruction was carried out after clashes had ceased. And this information, by the way, from the report entitled Jenin IDF Military Operations. IDF, of course, stands for Israeli Defense Forces. From Human Rights Watch, New York, 2002. And other reports, and one entitled Shielded from Scrutiny, IDF Violations in Jenin and Nablus, from Amnesty International, London, 2002. And cited in Norman Finkelstein's Beyond Chutzpah on the Misuse of Anti-Semitism and the Abuse of History, California University of California Press, 2005. Continue here with the text of the book. Amnesty and HRW both found that most of the destruction was carried out after clashes had ceased. Israel used bulldozers to minimize soldier casualties. But no one knows how many Palestinians died in the attack. With help from the United States, Israel disbanded a United Nations fact-finding team investigating the attack and simultaneously denied Palestinians access to the bodies of the dead, insisting on burying them themselves. Shortly afterward, Israel announced 46 casualties, less than one quarter of their original estimates. Israeli soldiers and Palestinian civilians' testimonies of unarmed men being executed and bodies being crushed suggest that this number is wildly inaccurate. Israel still maintains that a massacre never happened at all, and without access to the bodies, nobody can prove that those who went missing were actually killed. Again, I am reading from Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine, A Jewish-American Woman in the Occupied Territories, 2007. Although this book was updated and revised just last year. Continuing. Jenin Camp remains a field of destroyed houses, a sort of mass grave. One Israeli soldier was quoted by locals as saying he hoped they would make it into an Israeli football field. At present, it remains empty except for a few construction workers and several children running around playing among the ruined homes. We spoke to an old man who lived through the massacre. He told us his story. Here it is. A young girl who wanted to walk to school asked me to walk with her for safety. My son-in-law recommended that I go to the school first to check out the situation there. As I was crossing the road, a soldier standing at the window in a house 2 meters from me, that's about 3 feet, lifted his rifle and shot me in the hand. I fell down, clutching my wound. The soldier asked me to get up, but I said I couldn't get up because I was shot and bleeding. The soldier asked me, "Do you want to live or to die?" I pleaded with the soldier, and then he shot me again in the foot. At that moment, I realized that the soldier wanted to kill me. I lifted myself up and started crawling down the street. I arrived at the village center where I found 10 Israeli soldiers hanging out. They told me to go away. I crawled into the yard where there were more soldiers. I was covered in blood. A few soldiers checked me for weapons, and finding none, they gave me a bandage. The next thing I knew, I was in the Jenin hospital. As the old man told his story, he began to cry. He looked at us and asked, "Who is the terrorist, us or Sharon?" referring to the Prime Minister of Israel at the time, the late Ariel Sharon. He told us that he appreciated and respected the American people, but that he could not respect the pro-Israel, Jewish, and Christian Zionist American lobbies in the U.S. government, all of which continue to support America's role in sustaining the army that is committing these atrocities. Across the street from where the old man spoke lay the wreckage of a demolished house, where a mother and her paraplegic son had once lived. When soldiers came to destroy the house, she begged them to wait a moment for her to get her son out. They ignored her and bulldozed the house immediately. Several weeks later, neighbors found the flattened wheelchair of the son. His body was never recovered. Last April, again, this is in 2003, I believe. Last April, 1 year after, or perhaps 2004, 1 year after Israeli troops destroyed Jenin Camp, a 24-year-old American ISM volunteer named Brian Avery was coming around a corner in Jenin with several other international volunteers when an Israeli armored personnel carrier, APC, opened fire at his face with a machine gun. This was ISM volunteer Brian Avery, American. Witnesses confirm that he posed no threat whatsoever to the soldiers. It took 1 hour for Brian's friends to obtain permission from the army to bring him to the hospital. He survived the attack, but is permanently disfigured. We walk the streets of Jenin with ISM volunteers who know Brian and others. Sorry, there's a word missing in this sentence. I kind of have to improvise. We walk the streets of Jenin with ISM volunteers who know Brian and are interviewing parents of Palestinians recently hurt or killed in similar attacks. We walked past a hospital that had been bombed during an incursion, and we saw the frame of an ambulance that had exploded after soldiers opened fire on it. Three of the doctors inside made it out. One burned to death. His name was Dr. Khalil Suleiman. And yes, there's a footnote saying here, Ariel Sharon was Israel's prime minister at the time of our visit to the camp. We met with several doctors at the Red Crescent Society Clinic, to whom Dr. Suleiman had been a mentor. They said their workplace had suffered repeated attacks in recent years, as had the police station down the street, now a pile of rubble. They wondered how the Israeli government could demand that the Palestinian Authority, the PA, could control Palestinian violence when the military systematically undermines or destroys almost every element of the PA's infrastructure. A French artist welded together pieces of Jenin's broken ambulances into a huge statue of a horse, which now stands in the square outside the clinic. The horse symbolizes the endurance of the people of Jenin. Balzer says here, I wish I had more heartening news to report. The end of Ramadan is approaching, so there will probably be feasting and celebrating over the next few days. I hope it inspires some much-needed inner, if not outer, peace and joy for the people here. You are listening to the Saturday edition of the Mideast Migraine Show on Free Radio Santa Cruz, broadcasting at 101.3 FM and streaming live and for free at freakradio.org, freakradio.org. It is now 11:34 a.m. Reading from Anna Balzer's Witness in Palestine, 2007. The next page in her text journal here, Hawara Checkpoint and Nablus City. Thursday, November 27, 2003. Thanksgiving. that, of course, would be Thanksgiving here in the United States. This afternoon, I observed Huara, the southern checkpoint into and out of Nablus City. There, I met up with several Scottish volunteers from Women in Black, an international peace network opposed to war, militarism, and other forms of violence. When I arrived, the Women in Black were panicking because my colleague Kate was in danger of being arrested for arguing with soldiers at the checkpoint. That day, the rule was that most women, old men, and young boys weren't allowed through. But men between 15 and 40 years of age were denied... That day, the rule was that most women, old men, and young boys were allowed through, but men between 15 and 40 years of age were denied passage, period. It didn't matter where they were going. It didn't matter where they were coming from. It didn't matter who they were. If you were a Palestinian young man, you couldn't get to work, or to school, or to the hospital, or to wherever else you were going. All the men had gathered in a ditch next to the checkpoint to wait, hoping that the rule would change. A few men in the ditch started to pick up trash around the area, and I wondered why. The Women in Black volunteers wanted to go into Nablus to get some money, but said the soldiers had told them it was too dangerous. One soldier said, "You don't know what the Arabs are like. They don't care who they hurt. They will do anything. This is for your own protection." One Palestinian woman behind the Scots tried to get through and was also denied. She looked at the soldier pleadingly and asked, "Do you have children?" The soldier stuck the barrel of his rifle in her chest and pushed her away. Huwara is historically one of Palestine's most violent checkpoints. The main objects of our concern were two men who had been blindfolded and handcuffed 4 hours earlier. They were both fasting for Ramadan, and we began to worry about heat exhaustion as they sat crouched in the sun. A friend of one of the blindfolded men came and told us what had happened. He said one of the men, Wahid, was sick and had been referred by a doctor in his village to a heart specialist in Nablus. The soldiers told him he could not enter and handed him a trash bag, saying he should start picking up trash around the checkpoint instead. Wahid refused, saying he needed to go to the doctor and would not pick up trash for the soldier. The soldiers insisted, and when Wahid refused and tried to push his way through the soldiers, one of them struck him twice, in the gut and in the shoulder, with the butt of his rifle. He then handcuffed Wahid, blindfolded him, and sat him down in the sun next to two large trash bags. Now, I have mentioned in the past two shows, when I began the reading and spoke of this book, that one of the outstanding features of this particular book, Witness in Palestine, is that it is just full of, well, very high quality color pictures, needless to say, depicting a lot of misery and human suffering, or indications of human suffering. It is also, this book also contains many, many maps, including some historical ones of different parts of the world for comparative purposes, the situation in the occupied territories in Gaza and East Jerusalem, with, for example, the Bantustans, the Black African Bantustans in South Africa, Native American Indian land in the United States, and the sequential loss of such land by the native peoples. And so I would highly recommend your considering getting this book for yourself, as obviously this is a radio program and I cannot truly do justice to the graphics, pictures, maps, and reproductions of 12-year-old children's drawings of Israeli soldiers beating on Palestinian children, etc. You can, let me see here, go to, for one thing, you can go to ParadigmPublishers.com and inquire with them about receiving your own copy. It seems to me there is a separate website in here. Of course, I should have this down by now. Okay, well, at the very least, you can go to ParadigmPublishers.com. Paradigm is, of course, P-A-R-A-D-I-G-M, ParadigmPublishers.com, and inquire there. It really would be great if you can, if you, dear listener, can get your hands on this book, as it is such an excellent resource. ParadigmPublishers.com. Author Anna Balzer, Witness in Palestine, A Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories. You must not forget that part of the subtitle there, as obviously anyone who has ever been exposed to any depictions of the situation for Palestinians in their own homeland, in Palestine and in Israel, will tell you, they'll say things like, this sounds like a bunch of pro-Arab, pro-Palestinian, they will tell you, pro-terrorist propaganda garbage. But, and this is getting to be the case more and more these days, more and more Jewish people, both here, around the world, and in Israel, who have witnessed it themselves, are stepping forward. Jewish people in particular, of note, to give witness to the circumstances, Anna Balzer is, as the subtitle says, a Jewish American woman in the territories who is revealing these details. Okay, let's continue now with the text of the book. I never got to hear the story of the man next to Walit. Having avoided arrest, Kate came to say that there was nothing we could do, and we hurried to another checkpoint, hoping to get into Nablus before dusk. Two Machsom Watch, that's the Israeli checkpoint watch, volunteers stayed behind to work on getting the men released. Machsom Watch refers, of course, to the ISM, Women in Black, or other non-military watch individuals. We made it through the alternative crossing, Awarta checkpoint, easily. Evidence of how arbitrary checkpoint rules and security can be, and spent an hour in Nablus. The city was more vibrant and welcoming than I had imagined. I had expected that the occupation would have diminished Arab hospitality in Palestine. Not so. I took a walk through the old city to try and clear my mind of all the misconceptions about Arab culture that I'd picked up from Western media. Although Arabs are portrayed as violent fanatics opposed to values or habits different from their own, in my experience, this could not be further from the truth. All over the Middle East, I have been welcomed with curiosity, tolerance, and respect, sometimes all the more because I am a woman traveling alone and an American choosing to look beyond the stereotypes about Arabs propagated in the United States. As I walked through Nablus, children and adults came up to ask my name and where I was from. When I said I was from the U.S., they were quick to point out that their distaste for the American president did not affect their positive feelings towards the American people. They welcomed me to Palestine. Peace be upon you, I would say in Arabic, and their reply, and upon you peace. We left Nablus via the Hawara checkpoint to see if the blindfolded men were still there. They were not. The Israeli volunteers, these would be Israeli volunteers in solidarity with the Palestinians, had gotten them released. Additionally, there were several ISM volunteers on the scene. Unfortunately, the atmosphere was still tense, and there were now close to 100 young men in the ditch. One young man showed me his university card, saying he was a student in Nablus, and he hadn't been able to get home to his village to see his family for an entire week. It reminded me of a man I had seen that morning trying to enter Nablus to see his dying mother. He was worried he wouldn't be able to reach her before she passed away. After 15 minutes, one of the men still waiting in the ditch yelled, "Allahu Akbar, God is great," twice to signal sundown and the end of the fast. And within seconds, everyone in the ditch was passing around water, dates, the traditional food for breaking fast, and cigarettes. It was a moment of peace and thanksgiving. Just then, a Palestinian boy who had walked out of the checkpoint lineup was grabbed by his collar and thrown against a concrete block. The young boy put up his arms and cooperated with the soldier who had assaulted him. A heavy-set Palestinian who had been waiting for several hours bellowed at the soldiers to let the boy go. The man's voice was strong, but he was clearly on the brink of tears. The soldiers handcuffed him for causing a ruckus. An ISM volunteer calmly tried to intervene, but the soldiers arrested her as well. Night was falling, and we were worried about making it home. One soldier motioned for us to pass ahead of all the men, and we reluctantly accepted the privilege. The soldier looked at my passport and told me it was illegal for me to be in Nablus. He said, "It's violent and dangerous in Nablus." I told him it was more violent and dangerous there at the checkpoint than in Nablus. I asked him if he'd ever been to Nablus without his gun. He shook his head. I smiled and said, "It's different from what you think." He appeared to be considering my remark when I was pushed with the crowd through the line and hurried into a service taxi bound for home. This Thanksgiving, I am thankful for many things. I am thankful that I can leave my house, my town, and my country anytime I want. I am thankful for options, education, medical care, money in my bank account, and food in my stomach. I am thankful that we do not have a wall outside our house in Haris, although that is likely to change soon. Most of all, I am thankful for the miracles amidst the ongoing tragedy in Palestine and for the hope and steadfastness that remain here. I hope well-off Americans remember to be thankful for their relatively luxurious, peaceful lives today. The Palestinians have no trouble being thankful for what they have, so neither should we. It is 11:48 this Saturday, February 28, 2015. I'll read another entry or two in this full-text diary, and then we'll have a break in the reading for a little music and your opportunity to call in if you wish. Phone lines given out then. A reminder that, at least in instances when I can get the recording device working here at the station, the recordings of these readings, in addition to the recordings of my other Mideast Migraines scheduled slot every Monday at 3 p.m., are located in one of two archives. They are at alternate websites, radioforall.net. That's radio, the number four, all.net. Radioforall.net. Go there, type in Mideast Migraines into the search box, and you will receive a roughly chronological listing of all my shows, the latest on the top. So you may listen to those, or better yet, inform your friends, family, etc., about these programs, even people you think might not be all that interested in it, and they can listen to the programs at their leisure when they want to. You can also go to Santa Cruz Media Center, Indy Bay. That's Santa Cruz, two words, S-A-N-T-A-C-R-U-Z, as in the city or county of Santa Cruz here on the west coast of California. Santa Cruz, Indy Bay, I-N-D-Y-B-A-Y, and seek recent and not so recent recordings of the readings and my other programs there. You may also communicate with me through this program's email address, MideastMadness at gmx.com. MideastMadness at G as in George, M as in Michael, X as in Xavier.com. MideastMadness at gmx.com. You see, the program used to be called Mideast Madness, but I changed that a year or so ago to Mideast Migraines, which comes to you here on Free Radio Santa Cruz every Saturday, 11 a.m., and every Monday at 3 p.m. And before any of you, for whatever reason, choose to sign off, remember the talk, book talk, and lecture, I imagine, presentation, if you will, tonight at the RCNV at 612 Ocean Street, Santa Cruz, 7 p.m., Christopher Bolin, a 9/11 truther, presents Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, 7 p.m. at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. Let us continue. New journal entry. Outposts, Settler Violence, and the Village of Yanun. Friday, November 28, 2003. This morning, on our walk out of Haris, we met a farmer named Isam who said he had just been harassed by settlers from Revava settlement when he tried to reach his land between Revava and Haris. We offered to accompany Isam back to his land, and he led us to where his family was waiting with a donkey. Isam asked that just a few of us come along, including two Israeli activists. He said he was not interested in causing a scene. He just wanted to plow his land. Revava settlement was founded in early 1991 in the face of a suggestion by world leaders that the illegal Israeli settlements be evacuated. A few dozen religious Israelis snuck onto the land at night with trailers and set up camp. They refused to move, claiming the land belonged to them. And a footnote here indicates that information about the founding of Revava was collected through interviews with Revava settlers, Jewish settlers, who, by the way, are considered by Israel to be Israeli citizens. Continuing now with the writing. Settler trailer camps, like Revava once was, are called outposts. They are not recognized by the Israeli government, at least not at first. However, although Israeli law prohibits the government from subsidizing outposts the way it subsidizes most settlements, a majority of the 120 or so outposts in the West Bank and Gaza Strip are illegally funded by the Israeli state or public authorities. Strengthened by the state, the outposts welcome more settlers to move in, and the illegal establishments grow. And once again, because she mentions the Gaza Strip here, I must remind everyone that this text was written as early as 2003. The book was first published. This book, Witness in Palestine, was first published in 2007. And the Jewish settlements in the Gaza Strip were evacuated completely by Israel in 2005. Hamas came to power, was voted into power democratically in 2006. So the Jews were gone before the end of 2005 in the Gaza Strip. only, not talking about the West Bank, but before the end of 2005, they were out of Gaza, and this writing dates back to about 2 years prior to that. Continuing now. With time, the illegal cluster of trailers becomes akin to a small village or town. Soon the inhabitants need a marketplace, a road to get around, and maybe a fence to, quote, protect them from neighboring Palestinians. Eventually, the place is no longer an outpost. It's a settlement. Like many outposts, Rojava grew into its own settlement, now recognized and financially supported by the Israeli government. I repeat, Rojava grew into its own settlement, now recognized and financially supported by the same Israeli government which initially declared the outpost to be illegal. Things just have a way of perpetuating themselves and kind of running away. Okay, continuing with the writing. This strategy has produced many of Israel's settlements. Settlers recently set up trailers for a school in Issam's olive groves outside of Rojava. One can't help but wonder why settlers who frequently complain about the threat of Palestinians would build their children's school so far away from the settlement itself, in the middle of more Palestinian land. These trailers are not development, they are a new outpost. In another few months, the settlers will explain to the army that they need security around their children's vulnerably located school, and they will annex the rest of Issam's and other Harist farmers' land. But the government, the Israeli government, is one step ahead of them. If the wall continues as projected, again, referring to a writing from some 12 years ago, the wall has long been finished now. If the wall continues as projected, the villagers of Haris will lose most of their land anyway. The settlers know this, but they are impatient. While Issam and his family tried to plow, a settler drove up and asked if they would sell him their land. Issam said that this is not the first time settlers have asked. The Israeli activist told the settler in Hebrew that the farmer really was not interested in selling his land. These would be a pro-Palestinian activist. An Israeli activist told the settler in Hebrew that the farmer really was not interested in selling his land. The settler replied, "If he is smart, he will sell. I will buy it now for a tenth of its value. It will belong to Rojava anyway in a few months. At least this way he can make some money off it," end quote. The settler drove away, but before the family could return to plowing, a group of schoolgirls from the new outpost began to yell across the school's fence at Issam and his family. The children were singing a song in Hebrew about "My Israel." It was disturbing to watch the youngsters, so confident in their immunity as they taunted the farmers. I waited for their teacher to come out and stop them until I realized the teacher was standing in the middle of their group, singing along. Two Israeli activists walked towards the group of girls to talk to them, but settler security stopped them. Issam asked the activists to let it go, and he and his family preferred to leave rather than risk provoking the settlers further. He walked up to Haris roadblock, where he had found the army had set up a temporary checkpoint. All traffic into and out of the village was being checked. Some of my neighbors were being detained. When the soldiers realized that the activists with us were Israelis, they pulled them aside to warn them not to trust the Palestinians. "It could be very, very dangerous for you," they said. "We are concerned for your safety." Both activists said the only time they had ever felt threatened in the West Bank was by ideological settlers. Again, referring to Jewish settlers. Indeed, the religious zealots living in illegal settlements and outposts scare me more than soldiers or Palestinians ever could, because I don't understand them. Their actions are motivated not by fear or trauma, but by religious fanaticism. Nobody has been more traumatized by ideological settlers than the villagers of Yanun, where I headed later that day with my IWPS colleagues Jamie and Fatima. Jamie's friend Adnan picked us up from the town of Akraba and drove us the rest of the way to the village. The road to Yanoun was bumpy and slow, but the view was spectacular. To the left, we saw hill after hill of blooming olive groves, while on the right, the hills dropped off into a gigantic, misty abyss. It was the Jordan Valley. We could vaguely make out Jordan on the other side. As we drove, Jamie told us about the history of Yanoun. More than 80% of the village land is olive groves that inhabitants rely on. When we remarked on the beauty of the landscape, she explained that it is in fact the richness of Yanoun's land that renders it such a target for the right-wing settlers of Itamar settlement 4 miles away. Living in outposts surrounding Yanoun, Itamar settlers have been attacking and terrorizing the small village for years. They have murdered villagers, Palestinian villagers, who were peacefully picking their olives. They have burned the village's only generator and smashed its only water tank. They have swum in the village water supply. When villagers complained, the settlers invited their dogs in the water, too. They closed the only road into the village while shepherds were away with their goats. The only road into the village. They closed the only road into the village while shepherds were away with their goats, and the settlers have stolen 90% of the village's land. On it, more than 27,000 ancient olive trees. The settlers say the olive trees were planted by Jews 2,000 years ago, and therefore they belong to the Jewish people today. The mayor of Yanoun has been attacked by settlers 7 times in the last 5 years and has a large scar above his eye from one incident. Another old farmer had one of his legs broken and one eye poked out by a violent settler. Another villager lost his sight after offering an approaching stranger a cigarette. The stranger turned out to be a settler who beat the old man with his own walking cane. Adnan, our driver, was shot in the foot. Every family has a story. A mother throws her body over her child under a shower of stones from the settlers. Shepherds watch settlers poison 128 sheep, but can do nothing to stop it. Even international volunteers are not immune. They have been beaten with clubs and rifle butts for accompanying farmers and shepherds to their land. The Israeli government and army have done nothing to stop the settler attacks on Yanoun. In fact, Israel continues to subsidize Itamar, in part with American tax dollars. The Palestinian Authority couldn't do anything if it wanted to, because, like most of rural Palestine, Yanoun has so-called Area C status, Area C, which means that Israel is supposedly in charge of security. It also means that Palestinians are not permitted to construct any new buildings or even to build onto their own houses. Meanwhile, settlers continue to put up trailers on every hilltop. Let me read the footnote to these last two sentences here. Descriptions and geographical specifics of areas A, B, and C, as designated by the Oslo Accords, can be found on the West Bank map at the beginning of the book. Extensive Area C status is what Israel referred to as, quote, giving the Palestinians exactly what they wanted at Camp David 2. See Appendix 4 for more information on then Prime Minister Barak's supposed, quote, generous offer. Continuing with the book, the violence in Yanoun climaxed in 2002, when things became so unbearable that Yanoun's residents were forced to evacuate. Fearing for their lives, the entire village packed up and left their ancestral homes and lands for nearby Akraba. For a few days, the settlers had won. But Israeli and international activists quickly mobilized and committed themselves to maintaining a constant presence in the village if the inhabitants decided to return. About 90 of the original 300 inhabitants have now come back, but many houses remain empty. When we arrived in Yenoun, Adnan's wife, Mariam, welcomed us into their home, and we relaxed in the living room, drinking tea and watching the couple's 10-month-old son, Rafi, struggle to take his first steps. Although Jamie had been in Yenoun during the weeks before and after Rafi's birth, this was her first time seeing the baby. When Mariam went into labor, the couple took an ambulance to the nearest hospital in Nablus. The ambulance was stopped twice along the way at Satara and Huwara checkpoints. At the latter, Adnan was told he could not enter Nablus. He was forced to say goodbye to his screaming wife, who gave birth shortly afterwards while still in the ambulance. Shortly thereafter, the army closed Nablus completely, allowing nobody in or out, and Mariam waited for several days in the hospital with her newborn infant before being able to leave. Meanwhile, back in Yenoun, Adnan was beside himself with worry and frustration. When Mariam was finally allowed to return home, Rafi was 10 days old. Adnan had missed the first week and a half of his son's life. After we said goodbye to Adnan and his family, Jamie took us for a tour through the village. Children at every house ran outside to greet us, and their parents smiled from doorways. Jamie knew everyone by name and politely played the game of refusing tea until finally there is no point and you just have to give in. In one house, there was a little curly-haired redhead named Alima. Alima's one of my favorite kids in Yenoun, Jamie told us. When she first saw me, she thought I was a settler coming to take her family away and started screaming hysterically. It took the family 15 minutes to calm her down and explain who I was. I finally earned her trust. Yenoun is divided into two parts, separated by fields and olive groves. Lower Yenoun is populated by only two families, Adnan's and Lima's. The rest of the population lives in Upper Yenoun, which was built on the slope of a hill now crowned with a particularly violent outpost. On the path up to Upper Yenoun, Jamie pointed out the several houses that have remained empty since the evacuation. I could hear in Jamie's voice that she lamented the families not returning to defend their homes and land, but that she also understood why they had left. As resilient and undermined as the human spirit can be, it has its limits. These families weren't willing to risk their lives any longer. We visited house after house all the way up to the top of the village. When we arrived at the mayor's house, he welcomed us in, served us tea, and had us sign a guest book. Another family had a child anxious to learn English, so I gave her an improvised lesson. We ate dinner at the International House, where a group of Canadians had taken that week's shift as international observers in Yenoun. They were from the Ecumenical Accompaniment Program in Palestine and Israel, EAPPI, an initiative of the World Council of Churches to monitor and report human rights abuses and provide protection to vulnerable communities. After dinner, we made a fire under the stars and chatted with locals who stopped by to say hello. Sitting by the fire, I asked Dave, an EAPPI volunteer, to tell me about his experiences in Hebron. He described Hebron as a full-time war zone with a few hundred settlers living among hundreds of thousands of Palestinians. The settlers consider their presence a sacrifice to God, calling their settlement God's Bunker. He described graffiti on the walls of the local girls' school, stars of David drawn around phrases like "Death to Arabs" and "Arabs to the gas chambers." I'm just going to grab a little bit of my aging throat spray here. We're almost done with this segment, by the way. Thank you for bearing with. I'll finish up here and then we'll have our mid-show break. Dave shuddered as he spoke. Quote, "There were bars on the windows, but settlers came and stuck in pipes to break the glass. There was no money to fix them, so the girls shivered through the winter. After school, settler kids would hide and wait for the girls to walk by, throwing stones and eggs at them as they passed. The other EAPPI volunteers and I walked with them sometimes, trying to shield the attacks. Once as we were walking, I saw the mother of a settler child who was throwing stones at the young girls. I pointed and said, 'Look, look what your child is doing.' Her eyes fixed on me, and her expression said clearly that she approved of her son's behavior. She hadn't come to discipline her child. She had come to watch. I could not help but compare Dave's story with my recent experience watching the Rivava teacher taunt Palestinian farmers along with her students. There's nothing more disturbing than watching adults condone or encourage inhumanity and cruelty in their children. How will settler children learn to distinguish right from wrong? Perhaps a stronger human instinct will someday surface to guide some of them towards transcending their deeply ingrained prejudices. Heroes remain to guide the way. Issam refuses to sell his land to Rivava. Yanun returnees continue to live on their remaining land. But for how long while the world stands by and does nothing?" Let's break here. I'd really appreciate getting calls from the listeners. Through the magic of internet, I actually have a rough idea of how many people are tuned in. Whether or not they're listening intently might be another story, but I would indeed truly appreciate hearing from you out there, whether you have questions, elaborations, corrections, want to argue. I promise you I will do my best not to lecture, no matter how tense, perhaps, our conversation may become. But it is important that I hear from people and get some feedback. It is always appreciated. Two lines live to the studio here. Area code for both phone numbers is 831. Again, that's Santa Cruz County on the central coast of California. Area code 831. Line 1 is 427-3772. Again, 427-3772. Line 2 is 469-3119. 469-3119. Let's hear from you folks.
عالم فون المطرب عامر خداج
حول يا غنان حول بات الليلة قول يا غنان بالله شايف حبي وين قول يا غنان بالله شايف حبي وين غنام ماله ما بيوفيني يا زين العربان والله بحلف بديني طريق العين غادي غادي شفت زين قولي يا غنام بالله شايف حبي وين قولي يا غنام بالله شايف حبي وين ولا عم بشرب بقالي يومين قولي يا غنام بالله شايف حبي وين قولي يا غنام بالله شايف حبي وين حبيب قلبك في جاه الرحمن تحظي بي ويحظى بك وتعيشوا بأمان روحي الله يكون معاك بلك تلاقي زين قولي يا غنام بالله شايف حبي وين قولي يا غنام بالله شايف حبي وين
اسطوانات على المطربة سناء
يا قلبي يا
my friends. It's 12:22 in the afternoon now. You're listening to the Saturday edition, the book reading edition of Mideast Migraines, which comes to you every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. Broadcasting at 101.3 on the FM dial, pretty much to the limits of the city of Santa Cruz, and we are streaming live and for free, as ever, 24/7, as they say, at freakradio.org. That's freak as in F-R-E-A-K radio.org, freakradio.org. Tell your friends and enemies, family, everybody, that we're still both streaming and on air with occasionally exceptions to one of those due to reasons pretty much beyond our control. So if we're not on the radio waves, you can turn to our streaming service online, and if for whatever reason we have buffer problems or something else is happening online, you can try your radio. We are Free Radio Santa Cruz, a totally non-compliant with government agency, grassroots underground pirate radio service. We have been liberating the airwaves, as we like to put it, since 1995. This year is our 20th anniversary. In fact, it was March of 95 when this service began, long, long before my time with them. I'd been talking about our very general, admittedly rather vague plans for celebrating this 20th anniversary, and with the small central committee, as it were, of radio collective members, there are not enough of us right now who are going to be, that are going to have our hands free enough over the next couple of months to do any serious celebrating. It would help, perhaps, if we had more interaction with our listeners and members of the broader community. Of course, when I say broader community, what comes to mind most immediately are residents of the central Santa Cruz County. Of course, the broader community could mean anywhere in the world since we do stream online. Part of what I'm talking about, of course, has to do with donations. We, like so many other places that you hear from every day, every week, we badly need listener support. We can only cover so much of it. What I mean by we is members of the collective who produce and host our own radio programs, pay dues on a monthly basis, on a regular basis anyway, to keep this ship afloat, this pirate ship afloat. Arg. But the rest of it has to come from you. Our own bylaws actually prohibit us from seeking corporate or other major donor contributors from single sources, groups or individuals, because of the nature of pirate radio. The idea, of course, is to keep our airwaves open to news information and cultural programming from and by and for the people, not for the corporations who pretty much have all the other commercial radio services in the bag, in their own bag. So anyway, getting down to this donations business, please consider sending something. Even a small amount will do and is much, much appreciated. Send your check or money order, no cash, please. Checks, money orders to this address. Of course, Free Radio Santa Cruz, or simply write on the envelope, FRSC, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, S-A-N-T-A, second word C-R-U-Z, California, zip code 95061. Again, that's FRSC, Post Office Box 7811, Santa Cruz, CA, as in California, 95061. Don't forget, you may send your messages to the email address for this program, MideastMadness@GMX.com. MideastMadness@GMX.com. Recorded archives of my programs, and including hopefully this one within a week or so, available at radioforall.net, radioforall.net, or Santa Cruz Indie Bay, I-N-D-Y-B-A-Y, Santa Cruz Indie Bay. The music, by the way, that you've been listening to, that last piece, I began playing for you, Lamaya Albi. Let me get to the translations, at least of the title here. Yeah, that track four, starting with the latest one you heard, Lamaya Albi. When, O Heart of Mine, before that, Havil Yacharam, Stop and Rest, O Shepherd. And then you were listening to the one that I began the show with an hour and a half ago, Il Bulbul Naga, The Nightingale Coded. I'm sorry, The Nightingale Cooed. That makes a little more contemporary, folky sense. The Nightingale Cooed, Il Bulbul Naga. These musical numbers, of course, from my own personal prized compact disc collection, The Music of Arab Americans, a retrospective collection, 1977, Rounder Records Corporation, Massachusetts, Cambridge, Massachusetts. I think they dug into the archives, at least for some of these pieces, into the Library of Congress, to add to this, The Music of Arab Americans, a retrospective collection. I bought the CD back in Minneapolis almost 20 years ago or so. Reading from the book Witness in Palestine, A Jewish American Woman in the Occupied Territories. Copyright 2007, updated and revised to 2014. Would love to see a lot of faces tomorrow night at the Resource Center for Nonviolence, 612 Ocean Street, Santa Cruz, 612 Ocean Street, the big north-south boulevard there in Santa Cruz, California. That's tonight. Did I say tonight? Or did I say tomorrow? This evening, folks, February 28th, Saturday the 28th, 7 p.m. at 612 Ocean Street to hear Christopher Bolin talking about and selling copies of his book, Solving 9/11. What was the title of that? Solving 9/11, the tragedy that changed the world or something like that. I just don't have it in front of me right now. Okay, it's 12:30 in the afternoon. Some 30 minutes left. Let's do this. Phone ringers off again for now. Write to me at MideastMadness@GMX.com, and here we go with a new chapterette in Anna Balzer's journal, Witness in Palestine. Conversation with Omar in Balata Refugee Camp. Saturday, November 29. This isn't back in 2003. I took my first days off in Balata Refugee Camp in Nablus. First, I went to Huara, hoping to enter the city from the southern checkpoint, but the soldiers refused to let me through. It was getting late, and I was worried about getting into Nablus before dark, but I remembered our policy of not pleading with soldiers or asking for favors. We do not ask permission for something that is our right. and we do not validate the authority of soldiers whose presence in the West Bank is to protect settlers, Israeli Jewish settlers, in illegal colonies. That doesn't mean we don't treat soldiers with respect, but we are careful that respect does not appear to be consent for their illegal actions and presence. This is something we think and talk about a lot at the IWPS house, because we wish to distinguish between people in the institution that they are serving and to recognize their humanity even amidst the inhumanity of many of their actions and the occupation. I asked around for a taxi, for a service taxi to another checkpoint, but it was too late. A young man with whom I had shared a taxi noticed I was stranded and led me to a taxi full of other passengers who refused entry. We set off down the highway until we reached a spot on the side of the road next to a steep hill that had clearly been trodden. Everyone hurried out of the taxi, and I quickly realized that we were entering Nablus the long way over the hills to avoid checkpoints. We ran up to the summit and climbed over two roadblocks. There we found a taxi waiting to take us to a nearby town where we could find transport into Nablus. By the time we reached the city, it was after dark. The young man who had aided me in my journey led me to a shared taxi bound for Balata, where I was staying that night in the ISM apartment. He would not take any money for my part of the journey. I insisted, but he just put his hand on his heart and smiled to say that I was most welcome, and then walked away. Balata sees more violence and incursions than most other places in Palestine, which is evident as you walk through the camp. There are bullet holes in every house, school, and store. The children are tougher than those in other Palestinian communities I visited, and their parents are more suspicious. But the barrier is easily broken with a little Arabic and indication of solidarity. It was in Balata that I met Omar. Omar is a sad-looking man who works with ISM. Again, ISM stands for the International Solidarity Movement. A year and a half ago, on the day I graduated from my elite university in cheerful oblivion, Omar's cousin Mahmoud was shot 3 times with an army tank, tearing his body into 4 pieces. Mahmoud belonged to Al-Aqsa Martyrs Brigades, the military wing of the Fatah Party. Omar told me that Mahmoud had once been a Palestinian police officer, but found it impossible to be effective with constant Israeli military invasions undermining all efforts towards Palestinian self-rule. One day, Mahmoud confronted the raiding army with 2 friends. One of them was killed and the other sent to prison for over 20 years. He joined the brigades after that. When Omar's younger brother heard of his cousin's death, he was devastated. 5 days later, he strapped a bomb to his chest and blew himself up in a city outside of Tel Aviv, killing an Israeli woman and her 18-month-old granddaughter. Omar's brother was 18 years old. International volunteers stay at Omar's house in Balata, not in support of what his brother did, but in protest of the demolition order threatening Omar's family's home, which is a form of collective punishment in retaliation for his brother's crime. There is a picture of Mahmoud and Omar's brother in the front hall of the family's house. Balata camp is covered in pictures of men and women who have been killed by Israeli forces or who have killed themselves in attacks on Israel. They are revered and mourned by the community as martyrs, regardless of how they died. Omar and I spent the evening playing Palestinian backgammon and talking. Omar learned to play backgammon during his 7 years in and out of jail since 1985, when he was first arrested at the age of 13. He had been on his way to school when he was picked up by a jeep and put into prison for 6 months. The soldier who arrested him claimed he had thrown a stone, but Omar insists he never threw stones. Never, that is, until after he spent 6 months in jail. When he was released from prison, his attitude had changed. If Israeli soldiers were free to imprison him without trial for 6 months, he would have no qualms about throwing stones or Molotov cocktails. That was Omar's attitude until he started working with the ISM. ISM has a strict policy of nonviolence. I asked Omar what his friends and family thought of ISM's strategies, and he said, "They support my nonviolent resistance work with ISM. Most of my friends do, too. Yet the Israeli media says we are animals and killers. But they are killing us." Omar pointed to a crack in the ceiling and said this, "That is from a bomb that exploded the same night I stood at this window and watched my friend get shot on the street below. I wanted so desperately to go help him, but I couldn't because the army was shooting. I am powerless. I am part of ISM, but I cannot do checkpoint watch. It would have no effect. I cannot even go to an organizational meeting next week because there are 3 checkpoints between me and the meeting. With my last name, I will never make it. It is very frustrating, and as the occupation policies become stricter, it will become harder to find people sympathetic to ISM strategies. Nonetheless, I believe there is still hope for nonviolence. Even with one brother paralyzed from falling debris during a raid and another one with only 8 fingers after he lost 2 in the same raid. Even as I watched 3 of my cousins and my nephews spend their lives in prison." End of quotation, that description from Omar there. He looked at me, and I saw he had tears in his eyes. When he saw my face, he looked down, ashamed. "I'm sorry I make you sad. I shouldn't bother you with my problems." I encouraged him to continue, Anna said. He smiled. "Thank you so much for listening to me. I have nobody left to talk to, and I'm happy to know that you are listening." I nodded. Omar was ready to tell his story. These are his words as I remember them. These are his words. "I was crossing at a checkpoint near Nablus when a soldier asked me my name. I told him, and immediately he asked me about Mahmoud. 'Why did your cousin die?' he asked. I said, 'Because you killed him.' When the soldier asked, 'Why did your brother explode himself with bombs?' and I answered, 'Why do you think?' The soldier told me I would go to jail because my family was dangerous. I said that I was different from my brother, but he said that I was Palestinian, so I did not want peace. He called his men over to take me away. The police took me to a room where I was blindfolded and my hands were tied behind my back. 10 men beat me on and off for many hours. I remember it was raining outside. When they had finished, there was blood streaming down my face, so they took me to an army doctor. The doctor looked at me once and said, 'No problem,' although I was badly hurt. I waited for them to take me to my room where I could rest. Instead, they took me to another room where they beat me for about 1 more hour. When they had finished, they took me to a small, empty, dark room with water on the floor. They left me there, shivering on the floor with blood all over my body. Occasionally, they would bring me food, but it was food not even fit for animals. I did not eat for 3 days. After 5 days in solitary confinement, the captain told me I would stay in jail for 6 months. When I asked why, he repeated the reasons of the first soldier. He said I was dangerous, and that even if my brother was dead, the, quote, Arab wrath would continue in me. I'm going to interrupt the reading here for a moment to talk a little bit about what reading what the experience of me reading this is. For anyone, regardless of what your attitude is towards Arabs or Jews or Israelis or Palestinians or Islam, any of that, for anyone to listen to my words and for me to continue to go into extensive detail that Ms. Anna Balzer, an American Jew, is revealing here about life for the Palestinians on their own land. Well, suffice it to say, for me, it's certainly not a picnic. My friends, listeners, I am not enjoying what I'm doing here, not in the sense that one would set out or sit down and relax and enjoy something. I received this book, as I said at the beginning of the show, for the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation for a reason. And I'm sure it was not just for them to dispense items in their warehouse of books. The U.S. campaign clearly spends a certain amount of money, postage, handling, etc., to send these out to people. Yes, it is a reward of sorts for my annual donation to the U.S. campaign to end the Israeli occupation shortly after I made my annual end-of-year or beginning-of-the-new-year donation. I received it in the mail. I didn't even ask for it. I had no idea anyone even had the idea at the U.S. campaign to send me the book. But I realized very quickly that after I finished Freedom Sailors, the previous reading, which was the story of me and 43 other activists sailing across the Mediterranean into the Gaza Strip in 2008, I knew for sure that this would be the next book that I would be reading to you. So again, for anyone else who may still be listening to me, who is tiring and growing more and more morbid at the sordid details that Ms. Balzer has to tell us, just know, as I said, first of all, that I'm not exactly enjoying this. I find myself wanting to take longer breaks from having to read it. It's uncomfortable for me, as I'm sure it's uncomfortable for my conscientious listeners out there. I'm doing this show and reading this book out of a sense of duty, clearly out of a sense of duty. While I'm reading this book, I constantly have in the back of my mind those people who are arguing with me, well, what about all the horrible things that the other Arab countries do to their own Arab citizens? What about Iran? What about Hamas? Yes, what about all those other arguments that one could put up in comparison to what the Israeli occupation forces are doing against native Arabs on their own land? I'm not denying that those things happen. I do know that many of the horrible, maligning way that, say, other Arab governments torture their own citizens. I'm not saying it's not true, but I do know that some of these stories are exaggerated or in some cases are simply not true at all. At least statistically speaking, Israel, of course, and for that matter, even many in the American Jewish community will take and run with statistics that they get a hold of, which are generally supplied by Zionists and others in the pro-Israel camp, and they will make the Arabs sound like true monsters. As Balzer indicates in her book here, monsters, killers, savages, etc. Yes, there are many deflective arguments that can be made against even listening to Ms. Balzer's details about what Israel and its soldiers and its people and its politicians and its government is capable of. Above all I am really asking, just as Ms. Balzer said in the introduction to her book, that she is not asking everyone to take all of her words as gospel truth. I am not asking, she is not asking or demanding that her words be believed by everyone who reads them. Likewise, I cannot force anyone to believe what I'm reading here. And I'm constantly reminding myself, hey, it's only what I'm reading in a book. I have not experienced that. Although I have been in the Gaza Strip fairly recently, and I have had my own taste of very superficial and rather mild taste and observation of what life is like there for the Gazan Palestinians. But nonetheless, I have experienced it to a very minor degree. My experience in Gaza does not hold a candle to Ms. Balzer's witnessing an experience there and her observations there. She has really thrown herself into it. I was practically on a week-long picnic in comparison to what Ms. Balzer and many other solidarity people have experienced in the occupied territories. She is a real hero, even to put herself in the line of fire, as she, or potentially so, as she describes it here. But again, getting back to my broad message, my most basic message here is whether or not you believe Ms. Balzer's words or my reading of those words about what Israel does, don't forget what you're hearing. And the next time you hear a deflective argument, an argument that tries to take attention away from Israel's sins because of something that's going on under the authority of the PA or some Arab neighboring Arab states, treat all these stories as the individual stories that they are. Don't get into fruitless vain attempts at comparing the amount of horribleness that you hear in these stories one to the other and find yourself saying, well, after all, it's not so bad in Israel because they're a democracy, quote unquote, and use that as a launching pad for your defense of Israel if you are inclined to defend Israel. Treat all of these stories, no matter where they come from and no matter who they talk about, as individual truths, individual scenarios, wherever they come from. And stop pretending that somehow Israel is above all this. Israel, quite obviously, and from many points of view now, by my own research and digging into this, Israel is truly indeed capable of the most horrible of things, and in that sense is just another despotic Middle Eastern regime. Forget this business about Israel being a supposed democracy or being a bastion of Western civilization in the face of the barbarous Arab countries. It is indeed is Zionism is a settler colonial project. The whole thing is, not just this, the illegal settlements in the territories, but Israel itself. Even if I'm willing to say let bygones be bygones and let the Jews stay there, even if I do not push for every last Jew to be ousted from Palestine, and that is not my position, I do not call for that, I still say that it is a Zionist entity in the form of a legitimate nation that is constantly in the process of expanding its presence and ethnically cleansing the land of ethnic Arabs, of Palestinians. And they do these things in the most horrible of ways. Okay, now we only have 10 minutes left of the program. I want to continue with this business with Omar here in this chapter. Again, we're talking about a conversation with Omar in Balata refugee camp. This is not fun, folks. I'm doing this because I have to. We're still in the middle of the statement from Omar, this description to Anna Balzer. Last thing he said was, the Israeli soldier was saying that even if Omar's brother was dead, the Arab wrath, quote unquote, as the soldier described it, would continue in me. Which is pretty bizarre. You have an Israeli soldier admitting that there is this built-up sense of wrath in a Palestinian based on his experience at the hands of the IDF. Here we go, continuing. This is still the statement from Omar. The next 6 months were a living hell. If a soldier ever asked me if I prefer prison or death, I will not have to think twice. The bathrooms in jail were repulsive. Every day we had half an hour for 30 people to use one toilet. We were all sick with not being able to go to the bathroom. And when we complained that it was not enough time, the guard told us, "Don't worry, you can go tomorrow." There were boys there only 14 years old. And there was an 80-year-old man who was very sick in bed crying. I told the guard he needed a doctor or he was going to die. The guards answered, "He is dangerous. 80-year-old man here. He's dangerous. If he dies, then the people of Israel will be safe." End quote. 1 week before my prison time was finished, I could not sleep. I was tortured with fears that they would decide to keep me for another 6 months, or worse, that they would deport me to Gaza so I could never see my family again. And then they told me I could go. It was a wonderful feeling of freedom, until the reality sank in that I was returning to life in another cage. I had gone from one prison to another, a bigger prison called Balata. I am still in prison. We all are. Omar is luckier than some. He was on Amnesty International's list of illegal political prisoners until he was released. Still, he remains trapped. He's desperate to leave Palestine. One international invited him recently to visit Germany. He applied for permission to leave, but Israel rejected the application. Palestinians in the occupied territories have no citizenship and cannot travel or migrate without permission from Israel. The police say Omar is dangerous, and I am reminded of how people become what people expect of them. I hope that Omar will be stronger than that. He says he hopes so, too. I asked Omar if his brother had warned him before he killed himself and others. Omar looked at me incredulously. "Are you kidding? Do you think I would have let him go?" His anger turned to tears. Quote, "I would have locked him in the house and brought him food and never let him out of my sight. He was my baby brother. And if I ever meet someone who knew what he was going to do and didn't tell me, I'll never forgive them." I asked Omar if he wanted to tell me about his brother. He smiled and looked off into space. "He's not my brother anymore. He's a part of me, inside of me." Omar patted his chest. "I still feel him here. He was great, very charismatic, always coming home with a new crazy hairstyle. He loved to dress up nice and wear fancy cologne, and he couldn't wait to buy a car to drive the pretty girls around." Omar laughed for the first time that night. He said, "He was the only person around who didn't smoke. He hated cigarettes, and when I smoked, he would yell at me that it was bad for my health. He was so smart. A year before he died, he'd finished high school and wanted to study in a university, but didn't have the money. He had worked 3 years in a small hospital in Israel, but lost his job, and the Second Intifada started. After that, he was working odd jobs to save up the money for school. He wanted to be a doctor." Omar turned to me with a big smile. "Thank you for asking." I smiled back sadly. I didn't know what to say. There were no words to comfort. How could I tell him he was not alone when so much of the world has turned their backs on people with stories just like this? He kept apologizing for troubling me, which broke my heart. I told Omar I wanted to tell him something. He listened. I looked him in the eyes and said, "I'm Jewish." He looked surprised, but kept listening. Balter continued, "My family also has a devastating history. My grandparents were refugees from the Nazi Holocaust, and most of their parents, sisters, and brothers were killed by the Nazis." Omar cocked his head and shook it slowly. A pained look had come into his eyes. He spoke, "I see Sharon as a second Hitler. I hate Sharon, but I do not hate Jews, and I do not hate you. God loves everyone, Muslims, Jews, Christians, everyone. If you do good, then you go to heaven. God doesn't distinguish, and neither do I." I am not writing this account to excuse what Omar's brother did. It is appalling, and likely only inspired more violence. Interactions like the one I had with Omar don't make the tragedies any more bearable. But they do remind me that Palestinians who attack Israelis or Israelis who attack Palestinians are not homicidal maniacs. Many on both sides truly believe that the other is out to destroy them and that violence is their only hope of survival. Fear makes people do things they otherwise would not. The struggle is to revive the humanity amidst the fear. It's hard to feel human in Palestine with the wall closing in and the threat of imprisonment always lurking. There are more than 8,000 Palestinian political prisoners being held in Israeli prisons today. Reminder, this was written in 2003, 12 years ago. 8,000 political prisoners being held by Israel, about 10% of whom are in administrative detention, meaning they can be held without charge or trial indefinitely. This, of course, according to Israeli military law. Approximately 40% of all Palestinian men in the occupied territories have been detained or imprisoned by Israel. Almost every day I meet former prisoners. In Nablus, a young man not much older than me saw me looking confused and asked in English if he could help me. I needed a phone, and he let me use his. I asked him where he had learned English, and he said in prison in Israel. He had just been released the year before, after 9 years in prison, from age 18 to 27. The stories don't end. They multiply. Tonight I received a call from the father of a 23-year-old accountant named Amjad, who was arrested this afternoon at Huwara checkpoint without explanation. I tried calling the military prison where they thought he might be, but the prison operator was unwilling to talk to me. I immediately called the Israeli human rights organization, Hamoked. They had more luck phoning in Hebrew and located Amjad, who is being held for inspection without charges. He has never had any problems with the army, and his family is extremely upset and worried. They are not allowed to visit him, nor can he contact them. This is the end of the show and the end of today's reading. I'll begin next Saturday's show at 11 a.m. Pacific Standard Time with the entry on November 30th, 2003, on the way to the Samaria ruins. Until then, or perhaps until you care to join me 2 days from now, Monday, 3 p.m. Pacific Time, for that weekly edition of Mideast Migraines here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. 101.3 on the FM dial, streaming live at freakradio.org. Don't forget Christopher Berlin this evening, 7 p.m. at 612 Ocean Street. That's the old white church building on Ocean Street. 612 Ocean Street, the Resource Center for Nonviolence. talking about his study of what really happened on September 11th, 2001, and what all that was really about. Christopher Bolin tonight at 7 p.m. at the RCNV. Thank you for joining me.